Okay, well, I guess it's time to start the morning session. I am the chair. I'm Steve Gubser. I'm the chair of this session. I guess people are having a little trouble getting up on a Saturday morning, but I'm glad you're all here. Before we begin the first talk, I want to announce a small change in venue. Sav Sethi is going to talk, instead about the D0, D4 brain bound state, he's going to talk about warped compactifications. So if some of you are more interested in warped compactifications than D0 brains and D4 brains, you may want to be sure to come to his talk. Okay, so our first speaker this morning is Andreas Milga, and he'll be speaking to us about normalized supersymmetric vacuum states in the D equals 10 supersymmetric Yang-Mills quantum mechanics with any gauge group. Title of record length.
Okay. I will talk today not about complicated things like brain strings and so on. I will talk about just quantum mechanics. And the system I'm going to analyze is written here. Actually, as you recognize, it's obtained by dimensional reduction of 10-dimensional supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory to 0 plus 1 dimensional space. But it's still just a quantum mechanical system. It has finite number of degrees of freedom, vector potentials, and I and J, they live in 9-dimensional normal space. And A max gauge group and so on. Now lambdas belong to representation of 16 of SO9. And wave function, Hilbert space presents wave function which depends on gauge potentials and on holomorphic fermionic variables. So it's some fine point. The fermions which are here in the Hamiltonian are Majorana fermions, and you build up some complex fermionic variables which don't belong to any representation of SO9. That's some distinction compared to more simple models. And this model is supersymmetric, that is, you can write the supercharge, and the normal supersymmetric algebra is written here. Just a remark, here you notice it's alpha tilde and beta tilde, so alpha tilde and beta tilde would change from 1 to 8, and just alpha and beta from 1 to 16. Now the question is why I am talking about this model. So first question, why I started it myself? Well, the answer is because I find this story very beautiful and I had fun studying it. That's the answer for me. But it seems that this problem is relevant for brain physics. And this aspect I will almost not talking about because I really don't understand it. I will probably mention some points about that in the middle of the section. But anyway, this system is called another name for it. It's matrix model. And so let's call it 10-dimensional matrix model because it comes from 10-dimensional super Yang-Mills theory. And I will also talk a little bit about four-dimensional matrix model and six-dimensional matrix model coming as appearing as dimensional reduction of correspondingly n equals 1 and n equals 2 theory. So if you want my raison d'etre here is that this particular model is relevant to brain physics. But let's just analyze it as it is. And the question is, what is the spectrum of the Hamiltonian in the low energy region? It was known already for some time that the spectrum involves a continuous component starting exactly from zero. Why is that? On the classical level, the Hamiltonian is the potential is zero on the vacuum value, so it's classical vacuum value, the commutator of different spatial components of vector potential are zero. And as it's a supersymmetric system, this value is not lifted by quantum corrections, so fermionic and bosonic zero-point energy cancel out. And so the system wants to smear along this valley because the energy is not lifted by quantum correction, so it wants to go there, and the motion is unbounded, and that's why the spectrum is continuous. How should you describe, what is the proper way to describe this motion? The proper approach is Born-Oppenheimer approach. You separate fast variables and slow variables and write down the effective Hamiltonian depending only on slow variables. What are slow variables here? Slow variables are not all vector potentials, but only those which belong to Cartan subalgebra of the gauge group. Here R is the rank of the gauge group. And the fast variables are all the rest, modular gauge degrees of freedom. How the effective Hamiltonian looks like? Well, actually, it was written back in 82 by Witten in a seminal paper, Constraints on Supersymmetry Breaking. Well, it was written for more simple case for four-dimensional matrix model, if you want, but actually it's the same in all other cases. It was just written there, and some papers in the second half of 80s, I derived it more or less in systematic way in the framework of Born-Oppenheimer procedure. I also derived some other things, so what is the effective Hamiltonian for chiral gauge theories, what are corrections in Born-Oppenheimer parameter for non-chiral theories and so on, but that's not my subject today. It's not just, so it's basically a Laplacian because it's derivative, but not all eigenstates of the Laplacian belong to the spectrum because you should impose the requirement of wild invariance on the wave function which depend on slow variables, and this wild invariance is the remnant of the gauge invariance for the full Hamiltonian. As I mentioned, the spectrum involves continuum component. One application of this result for the brain physics is that the mass spectrum of supermembranes is continuous. It was known also for 10 years. Recent finding was that this system involves also normalized supersymmetric vacuum state. So there are solutions to this equation, supercharge acting on the wave function gives zero, with wave function which is normalizable, this integral is less than infinity. And that's specific of a 10-dimensional matrix model. It's not so for four-dimensional and six-dimensional matrix model. And there are at least three different ways to see that, and all these ways of reasoning lead to one and the same answer. The first, and historically the first way, and also the most rigorously, most bulletproof, if you want, method of obtaining this result, is by calculating the Witten index for this system. And I will start with that, but just mention here that the most simple method is this one, and it is with this method which we obtained new results for complicated gauge groups. And also there is third method, asymptotic wave function. I will talk about it in the end of my talk. So how to calculate the index of the Hamiltonian, because if the index is non-zero, there are supersymmetric vacuum states. So normally it's defined like that. difference of bosonic and fermionic vacuum states. All excited states cancel out in the sum if the spectrum is discrete at least. And this trace can be written as a in the functional integral form. And if beta is small, it doesn't depend on beta, supposingly. And if beta is small, then you can write this functional integral as just finite dimensional integral. And this finite dimensional integral for SU2, well, not for any, for any gauge group, is written here. This integral was actually been calculated by me back in 86, but I didn't have pre-factor correct. I need some factor one quarter of one over eight. This factor was written correctly in these papers, and they, these people obtained this result for this particular integral for Witten index. Now, please just look at the first line in this table, because I will explain what are other lines afterwards. So you see that the results are fractional. You have one quarter in four-dimensional matrix model, one quarter in six-dimensional matrix model, and five quarters in ten-dimensional model. And that makes no sense, because Witten index should be integer. That's the number of bosonic and fermionic vacuum states. What's going on here was the reason. The reason, of course, is the presence of continuum spectrum. Because, for example, the statement that this trace doesn't depend on beta is true only for the systems with discrete spectrum, and for the systems with continuum spectrum, this value depends on beta in principle, and that should be taken into account. Why it depends on beta? Because for the systems with continuum spectrum, you don't have sum over state, but rather the integral like that. And even in supersymmetric system, it's not necessary that the spectral density of bosonic states and fermionic states coincide. Now, how to calculate that? Actually, you see that this fractional value comes from the continuum spectrum. So if you want, this value of the index is contaminated by the presence of continuum spectrum states. And to fix it correctly, you should calculate separately the contribution due to continuum spectrum states. And this contribution is not difficult to calculate, because low energy states of the continuum spectrum are described in the framework of the effective Hamiltonian, which is much more simple. It's just free Laplacian. And you should calculate the same integral, functional integral for index, in the system with effective Hamiltonian. And the result is that you obtain one quarter for all variants of the theory. So it's these red values. And if you subtract red values from the blue values, you obtain this result. So you obtain that there are no normalized vacuum states here and there, and there is one normalized vacuum state for SU2 gauge group at least. That's the result for SU2 for 10-dimensional matrix model. No, it's just one normalized vacuum state in this model, and the wave function depends on the gauge field, but on zero mode of the gauge field. It's a quantum mechanical system. It's not field theory. It's not the Witten index and field. I don't understand. Box in the field space, I don't want to put. Why should I put the box in the field space? I don't want to do that. The configuration state for the field is unbounded. Huh? Because it's just Laplacian? Leading correction, I know for the supersymmetric electrodynamics, yes. For the supersymmetric electrodynamics, I calculated it explicitly, leading correction in the Born-Oppenheimer parameter. Well, probably I will show it later, because it's not quite, it's, the matrix appears, first of all, it's not just flat space anymore, the matrix appears, and there are corresponding fermionic terms and so on. Okay, now that was SU2, the result for SU2, and here are the results for high unitary groups. So these people calculated this integral, complicated integral, analytically, and these people confirmed it by numerical calculation for first few groups, SU3, SU4. So you see the result. That's what is called principal contribution. This, well, multidimensional but finite dimensional integral which I talked about, this is called principal contribution. And the red values is what is called deficit term. That's the contribution of low energy continuum spectrum states. I will actually talk later probably how these particular values are obtained, just, but right now I just mentioned that it's true. And if you subtract red values from the blue values, you obtain green 001. Again, the same result as for SU2. Now, how the same result can be obtained in a very simple way? By another method. Not so rigorous, but very much efficient. That's the method of mass deformation suggested by these people. So let's think of our quantum mechanical system as the system obtained by dimensional reduction over four-dimensional theory. Four dimension, n equals four field theory. Then, you have nine components in 10-dimensional vector potential. There are three components which are still gauge potentials, and other components have the meaning of the Scalar fields. There are three Scalar fields like that. And there is nonlinear interaction, so that in n equals 1 superfield notation, you have superpotential written here. Okay, now what I want to do, I would want to just to add to this superpotential the term involving the mass of the field. I'm just giving the mass to Scalar fields and write superpotential in this way, in this form. And now there is no n equals 4 supersymmetry anymore, but n equals 1 supersymmetry is still there. So the system is still supersymmetric, and the notion of the Witten index makes sense. I want to calculate Witten index for large values of mass, and then I just say that it's the same for small values of mass, because it cannot change abruptly when you change continuously a parameter. And so eventually I want to say it is the same for zero mass. Now, how to obtain the value of the index for large mass? The problem is very much simple, because you don't need to solve quantum mechanical problem, but it's enough to solve just classical equations of motion. If the mass is large, then there is large gap in the spectrum. You can just solve the classical problem. Classical problem is what? That F term is equal to zero and D term is equal to zero. And, It does what? Yes. Yes. That's one of the examples. Indeed, I agree that this procedure is not quite rigorous. And so the results, which I will talk about later, which we obtained by this method, should be confirmed, should be verified by other methods. But this actually was the ideology of this old Witten paper. Half of the Witten paper is devoted to this method. You modify the theory, you calculate the index in the simple case, and then you make a conjecture that it's the same in completely different values of the parameters, where then you cannot calculate it directly. So that is an assumption, and I will comment about that a little bit later, about this assumption. But let's, for time being, assume that it's correct. Yes. That's true. That's true. But even here, in principle, it's possible that the normalized state for non-zero mass becomes not normalizable in the limit m goes to zero. I cannot prove that it's not true, though I think that it is true. Yes. Yes. Well, maybe we'll discuss it with you later. I saw your paper, but you cannot really go to the limit m0. You can estimate this the size of this of the state when m is still not 0. And you actually don't know, at least I don't know, what happens in the limit m goes to 0. I believe that nothing drastic happens, but I cannot prove it. Now, what... Oh, okay, maybe. Hmm? I don't hear you. Yes. They give mass to all gauge fields, right? By the Higgs mechanism. So there is a non-zero expectation value of the Higgses, and they give mass to all gauge fields. It's important that they give mass to all gauge fields, so that there is now a gap in the spectrum. Now, this is the solution for this system, trivial solution, and there is one vacuum state for SU2. Now, what happens for other groups? You should solve purely mathematical problem. You should embed SU2 gauge algebra in arbitrary Lie algebra. So you see this G, I tried to write Gothic G. That's the first thing you should learn when trying to solve this kind of problem, to write Gothic letters. And both SU2 small, you see these letters are supposed to be lowercase to distinguish it from the group. And G Gothic are complexified Lie algebras. And the number of vacua, and okay, and all embeddings such that in mathematical language, the centralizer of this triple of the embedding is trivial on the physical language. All such embeddings which give mass to all gauge fields are the solutions, are classical vacua, and one should just count this vacua, factorize over conjugacy, that means gauge transformation, okay? So all gauge non-equivalent solutions to these equations, you should count them. And this problem was solved actually by mathematicians, not quite this problem. It was formulated a little bit differently. Okay, so-called distinguished nilpotent elements of complexified Lie algebra were classified by these people. And actually it turned out that it's one and the same problem. And so I will not probably talk in too much details about this general proof, how it's proven, but this is the result. So there is only one embedding for all unitary groups, so there is only one vacuum for unitary groups. For symplectic groups, the number of vacua is equal to the number of different partitions of R, rank of this symplectic group, into distinct parts. What is distinct parts? So it's explained here in the example. The first non-trivial example is SP6, where you have two vacua, because 3R, which rank 3, is just 3 on one hand, and on the other hand it's 2 plus 1. You have two vacua. And for SP12, you have 4 vacua, because you have 6, partition just 6, 5 plus 1, 3 plus 4 plus 2, 3 plus 3 doesn't work, because it's not distinct parts, it's one and the same part, it doesn't work. But what works is 3 plus 2 plus 1. Now, for orthogonal groups, the number of Becky is equal to the number of partitions of N into distinct odd parts. And the first non-trivial example is SO8, 7 plus 1 equals 5 plus 3, and for SO9, also 9 equals 5 plus 3 plus 1. And these are the numbers for exceptional groups. Now I just want to bring your attention to this number. Jan Kogan, whom I talked with recently, thinks that it's very interesting. You get 11 states, and that problem has something to do with 11 dimensions for the M theory. But that's up to you guys to. And also probably this is a good point to say something about M theory. Those little things which I understand. It was somewhere here. So these bound states are interpreted for, at least for unitary groups, as normalized bound state of D0 brains of some gravitons with the modes in this 11th dimension. And actually, I was get interested with this problem when I heard the talk by Nikita Nekrasov in Moscow in the conference with the title that is Theorem of Existence for M Theory. So he understands, and you also, many of you also understand, why the existence of this bound state is important for the M theory to be reasonable. Now I will return to this classical vector, the examples. So for high unitary groups, there is unique embedding, and it's very difficult to build up. You just should take the generators of SU2 in the representation with the spin of the corresponding dimension. And that's it. There is nothing else. Now let's discuss symplectic group SP6, because it's the simplest example where you have two in equivalent vector. So what is first of all SP6? It's a subgroup of SU6, living invariant, this particular form. C is written here. If you want, it's the matrix of complex conjugation. And there are two embeddings, two non-equivalent embeddings. The first embedding is written here. So H is the equivalent of sigma 0, sigma 3. E is the equivalent of sigma plus, and F is equivalent of sigma minus, right? That's their algebra. That's how they commute. And you can be convinced that this triple has trivial centralizer, so that it gives masses to all gauge fields. And what else? It's the same as for SU6. If you write the solution of these equations for SU6, you get the same solution. So this particular embedding is the same as for SU6 and is given by the generators of SU2 with spin 5 halves. And let me just show you non-trivial embedding for SP6. It's written here. That's sigma 3, and that's sigma plus, and that's sigma minus. You see that it's already not so trivial. But you can show that the centralizer of this triple is trivial in the algebra SP6. And you can ask now what is the centralizer of this triple in the group SP6. And you find out that it's Z2 cross Z2. This Z2 is just the center. It should be, because everything commutes with the center. But you obtain something else, some other Z2. And what is this some other Z2? That's some residual gauge, discrete gauge symmetry. So you found that in this particular example, your three complex scalar fields give the mass to all gauge bosons, okay? So the continuous gauge symmetry is destroyed, but the discrete symmetry is still there. And actually, all the examples which we constructed have this feature. Well, almost all examples. Residual discrete gauge symmetry, it might be interested by itself without any regard to M theory or to this quantum mechanical system. So we have a lot of examples where the gauge symmetry is broken down completely, on the continuous part is broken down completely, but the discrete gauge symmetry remains. And what is also interesting that here it's just Z2, or for some higher orthogonally symplectic groups, it's several Z2, several factors of Z2. But for exceptional groups, the residual gauge group is non-abelian. It's the group of permutation of some number of the elements, and the highest group is S5 in one example for U8. And let me show you this picture just for fun. So what is drawn here are so-called well, Dynkin diagrams. You recognize, of course, Dynkin diagrams, but there are black spots on the nodes, and these black spots are marking, and I have no time to explain. It's kind of distinguished marking which from which you can construct these distinguished ripples whose centralizer is trivial. And this M is just characterizes this discrete gauge group, and here is the example I was talking about. Here, the residual discrete gauge group is S5. And you see, for E8, for example, there are 11 such pictures corresponding to 11 different solutions. Now, probably I will accelerate about. I already talked about this first method of obtaining the value for the Witten index, and it was carried out until then for unitary groups. For more complicated groups, it was not carried out because it's a difficult task to calculate this integral I shown you. Nobody has calculated it so far. But what is not difficult to do is to obtain to calculate the deficit term, because this deficit term depends only on the effective Hamiltonian, which is just Laplacian. If I have what? Rank greater than one. Okay. Yes.
Yes.
Okay, so I will explain it later. So there are, first of all, directions large value of abelian gauge fields, right? And they contribute something to this deficit term. There are some other contributions. I'm going to talk about that. But first, you see, what I write here is proper deficit term in quotation mark. The contribution to the deficit term, which comes from this large value. Now, how to calculate it? Well, you can do that, and I'm eating the details. It was the paper of Green and Gutterle, more or less. You can write such formula, so that proper deficit term is just the sum of the all elements of the Weyl group. So here W stands for Witten, and here W stands for Weyl. Of this particular, this particular thing, and sigma prime means that you sum over all terms where this determinant is not zero. Now, for unitary groups, the only contribution to the sum comes from so-called Coxeter elements. So when all cyclic permutation of the roots of SUN, and you can calculate it that it's 1 over n squared. That's a proper deficit term. Now, for other groups, different kind of elements contribute to the sum, and when you are not able to obtain nice formula for all groups, but we calculated it for first groups, this sum. Just a comment that similar sum, but not one over determinant, rather determinant squared, can be calculated once and forever for all groups, and this is just R plus 1. I is the rank of the group, and this is relevant for the calculation of Witten index for four-dimensional field theory. And here this is relevant, and you obtain for unitary groups. I have written already what you obtain. And that is what you obtain. Well, okay, so I tell you later, okay? I will show you this table later. Besides this property deficit, there are other contributions coming from so-called sub-values. Let's consider the example of SU4. So there is large value corresponding to diagonal matrix with three arbitrary entries, four entries such that the sum is zero, but consider this particular sub-value with only one parameter. Now, the centralizer of generic such element is SU2 cross SU2, non-abelian as you want. And this non-abelian, so the scheme of separation of fast and slow variables is modified now. You have non-abelian directions in the fast sector. And as you know that with SU2 group, you have normalized vacuum state, you have the contribution to the index. So I probably have no time to explain in more details. Now, why you have contribution in this case? Because this sub-value is invariant under a certain subgroup of the Weyl group, which just permutes these two elements with these two elements. And on the other hand, this subgroup acts non-trivial on one particular element of this sub-value. So you, for an arbitrary group, you should just take the sum over all subalgebras of Cartan subalgebras. Well, here is my attempt to write Gothic H. I think it was not quite successful, but anyway. So you should just find all subalgebras of Cartan subalgebras which satisfy this criterion, take a sum. For unitary groups, you obtain that the only such subalgebras are SUM, where M is divides N. And so you get this result, which was obtained by people earlier. You get the sum over all divisors of N, 1 over M squared. And for other groups, you obtain something more complicated. So let me show you what you obtain. This is proper deficit term, and then there are different subvalues, different subalgebras. You can calculate all contributions, add them, you obtain something like that. That's total deficit term. And then, independently from this mass deformation method, you know that the number of vacua here is 1, here it's 2, and here is 1. And if you add that, you get prediction for this integral. So we cannot calculate this integral. But we are saying that if people will calculate it, then that's the answer they are going to obtain. And of course, it would be very nice to calculate it directly, if not analytically, then at least numerically for G2, where you have only 14 generators. I don't think that it's complicated. It's easier than for SU4, for you have 14 generators rather than 15 for SU4. And now I have some time left, I guess, right, to talk a little bit about the third method, about asymptotic wave function method. So suppose you have the solution, normalized wave function in the full theory, full matrix theory. Consider this solution in the region when the absolute value of A is very large. Then a Born-Herkimer approximation works, and you can write this wave function as this term. That's the wave function of the effective Hamiltonian multiplied by the wave function of oscillators in the fast sector, and plus all other contributions which are irrelevant when this condition is satisfied. S runs from 1 to R. And if this wave function satisfies the equation, the full supercharge acting on C is equal to 0, then this wave function satisfies the equation that the effective supercharge acting on high gives zero. Now the solution was obtained only for SU2 for time being. No solution is known for all other unitary or not unitary groups. These people obtained that, incidentally. Well, that's the way to, proper way, the most simple way to describe it, but they not only knew about my papers, which could be understandable, they also didn't know about this remark in the old Witten paper, and they obtained this Laplacian with a lot of efforts. Eventually they obtained this Laplacian, but they didn't even, write up the explicit expression for effective supercharge, and so it was difficult for them to find the solution. But if you do it properly, that's not so much difficult. So first of all, what is your effective wave function? It depends on bosonic slow variables, and for SU2, it's just nine-dimensional vector. And it depends on 8 holomorphic fermion coordinates. Now, what is the most general form of this wave function? It's written here. It's expanded in series in mu. So you have 256 components, like the polarization of supergraviton. Now you can classify this wave function under the representation of SO9. And it turns out that this 256 is reducible representation of SO9. Obviously, it's representation of SO9, but reducible one. And there's the decomposition. You have 44, which is symmetric second rank tensor, 84, which is anti-symmetric tensor of the third rank, and that spin vector, I alpha, right, 128. Now, that's just the answer for this asymptotic wave function. You take 44 representation, which is symmetric in IJ, and multiply by this derivative di dj, and what is that? That's nothing else as the Laplace, as the Green's function of the Laplacian in nine dimensions. So that's the answer, and why is the answer? Because you can show that when you act on that by the effective supercharge, you will eventually get this Laplacian. Two indices will are going to convolute, so you will get the Laplacian. Laplacian gets zero. And now the last remark. Recently, a paper appeared where our results were reproduced by for orthogonal symplectic groups by brain methods, on which I cannot comment. Okay, thank you. Free particle what?
You bring down a free particle Laplacian.
Ah, yes. No, I don't know. I know it only for supersymmetric electrodynamics, and that's why my work of 87.
Do you know there's not older one over R squared?
I don't know.
But then it's highly non-trivial to check that, and that would change the asymptotic
situation. No, no, because these corrections are irrelevant for large R. They are relevant for small R, but not for...
No, 1 over R squared is relevant for R.
Why? Ah, no, well, okay, so then I claim that the corrections are suppressed more than 1 over R squared. Well, I know because I can calculate this Hamiltonian. It's not just words. I can calculate in the framework of Born-Oppenheimer approximation. I see that I take into account systematically all leading terms, and non-leading terms are suppressed. That I see.
That's a non-trivial calculation, which we actually did many years ago. There's not many years
ago. Ah? Yes, I did it. I did this calculation, and it's not so much non-trivial, and it's written in details in this our paper with Katz, recent papers. It was not written maybe in so much details because I thought that it's clear, well, just by reasoning which were in the Witten's paper. But I did it at that time, and I write it down now in this paper, so it's not so much difficult. What the crucial, how do you do that? You don't find, it's just more simple. not to calculate the effective Hamiltonian, but rather to calculate effective supercharge. And to find the effective Hamiltonian as the commutator of effective supercharges.
It makes a very little difference. I mean, we did the computation both ways, more than 2 years ago. And it's
well, I don't know how. Actually, I don't know your work on this subject. I know that this Laplacian was obtained by Konechny with a lot of efforts. Laplacian. But not the expression for the effective Hamiltonian. And I will also say that it's Laplacian, and the effective supercharge is what I'm saying, and I can derive it in a much more simple way than Konechny did it. Why what?
I'm wondering what question Bob is thinking about, because I mean, the one I'm saying is the point of
R. Well, okay, I can write you something like that. Well, just write what I know for supersymmetric electrodynamics. Okay, I can write on the transparency if you want. So what I know, what is the result of supersymmetric electrodynamics in four dimensions? So you have your Laplacian, di squared, more or less. That's the leading order. And in the next leading order, you obtain some matrix. So you obtain this thing multiplied by 1 minus 1 over this von Oppenheimer parameter, GA cube. That's the correction. So, that's n equals 1, d equals 4, quantum electrodynamics, the simplest possible theory. Where the, it's already more or less complicated calculations. And the calculation of the leading term is relatively simple, and you can do it for all theories, and you can do for all theories also the corrections, but I did it for supersymmetric electrodynamics. So that's the correction. You see the matrix appears. It's conformal matrix. Gij is equal delta ij times this correction. And it's large when A is small, and it's small when A is large. Okay.